By the 1970s and 80s, Linda Ronstadt was one of rock's biggest and most alluring female stars. She sold millions of albums, won 11 Grammys, and her face repeatedly graced the covers of Rolling Stone, Time, Newsweek, and other national magazines. Her gorgeous voice and her vocal versatility helped her to simultaneously rise to the top of the pop charts, the country music charts, and the R&B charts. Ms. Ronstadt retired from performing publicly several years ago, and recently she revealed that she's suffering from Parkinson's disease. She's written a memoir, Simple Dreams, about her life and music. It's published by Simon & Schuster, and I'm very pleased it has brought her to our show today. Hello.
How do you do?
We were just listening to Different Drum, which you sang with your first band, the Stone Ponies. That was your first hit?
I think it was, actually. Yeah, it was.
I was surprised when I realized that Mike Nesmith of the Monkees wrote that
song.
He
was a good songwriter, and he went on to have a career of his own, separate from the Monkees. It was a good thing. He's a good writer.
And you just, when you were in that group, the Stone Ponies, you just heard that song and thought that it might be good for you?
Yeah, I learned it off a bluegrass record. I learned it off a Greenbrier Boys record with Johnny Harold singing it.
They did the first recording.
Yeah, and they sang it really well. And I said, that song's a hit. I'm going to sing that. And I did.
Have you written any of your own songs?
I write occasionally, and I don't think that's what I do. I've written some songs that I've recorded. Other people have recorded them also. But I think that's a separate gift, you know, and it's something that you have to learn to hone your skills for, learn the craft of, and I never did that. I just was mainly an interpreter.
When did you first realize that Different Drum was going to become a hit?
Well, we were driving along. This is funny. We were driving into a meeting to Hollywood to have a meeting at Capitol Records to find out, you know, what was going to go on with our future. And we had released this record, and they were playing it. We knew they were playing it in San Francisco, but there at that was the time of a local radio, regional radio, and there were things such a thing as a regional hit. So it seemed like it was maybe going to be a regional hit in San Francisco, but we knew if the L.A. Records radio stations didn't play it, it didn't have a chance. So the car froze. Apparently the engine froze, and it made this horrible sound when it was driving. It was so loud that it was turning heads in the street, you know. So we pulled it into a gas station, this screaming vehicle, and we got out, and we were scratching our heads, and the mechanic was looking at it. He said, oh, you know, this car's dead. It's never going anywhere again. You got to tow it to the junkyard. And we're, you know, this huge double bass, you know, and all your tars and all of us crammed into this car. It was our only bit of transportation. We were just stuck. And from way in the back of the gas station, I could hear this little, the sound logo for KRLA, which was the big hit station in Los Angeles. And I heard the beginning of Different Drum, and I went, wow, our record's a hit, you know, but we were, you know, I was like, what did it mean? We were stranded, we were stuck, we didn't have any money, and we were flat broke, and we didn't have a car. Los Angeles, of all places.
Where did the name The Stone Ponies come from?
It came from a Charlie Patton blues tune. And, I mean, those were the days, you know, when funk was God. You had to get something that sounded heavy. And Rolling Stone was the, you know, end-all, be-all, puritanical voice of whatever, you know, whatever was hip.
And Rolling Stone, of course, comes from a blues song as well, the name The Rolling Stones.
Yeah. So, and the Rolling Stones, you know, and so we thought, well, it'll be the Stone Ponies. I liked horses, so you got me a Stone Pony now. I'm going to ride the old gray mare. I think it has some kind of scatological reference, but we won't go there.
And that was your first group? Or you'd been performing before that.
I'd been performing with my brother and sister in a group called the New Union Ramblers. Same kind of deal, you know, we're trying to find a folky name. You know, how we cast about for an identity when we have none. And that was with my brother, Peter, and my sister, Susie. We sang, like, folky stuff, you know, tried our best to sound like Peter, Paul, and Mary or the Weavers or something like that.
You retired from public performing 4 years ago. Do you have any idea of how many years you had sung professionally?
Well, let's see. I started singing professionally when I was 16, and I was... Boy, it's hard. Four years ago, from 67 to 63, I guess it was 63 when I stopped singing. I don't know. Can you add that up?
Yeah, well, it doesn't matter. It was
a
long time.
I don't have, yeah, good. I think it was a lot of years. I'd have to write it down with a pencil
and
paper.
Well, I'm glad to meet somebody who's as bad at math as I am.
I'm terrible at it.
You recently announced that you'd been diagnosed with Parkinson's disease. Didn't you stop singing because you'd begun having trouble
Yeah, I couldn't sing at all. I was barking for a number of years and just kind of trying to recraft the way I could sing. And I thought of myself as singing as like an artist with a limited palate, you know, singing with a limited palate.
Did you assume that it was because of the aging process or the wear and tear of performing so many years?
I didn't think it was just age because I was listening to a lot of other people who were aging at the same rate that I was, and their voice wasn't changing the way mine was. Their voice was getting a little, it was, you know, it was losing some color. And some of the pretty airy sounds that you have in the top of your voice that you lose from getting older. But my voice, I couldn't do it. I couldn't phonate. It was my voice box wouldn't work. And I went to the doctor and he said, "There's nothing wrong with your vocal cords." You know, basically saying you're neurotic. So and I knew it was mechanical. I knew it was muscular somehow. I knew that I was given the command of the muscles to move, but the muscles wouldn't speak. And that's exactly what was happening. So, and at the same time, I would start trying to walk. Like, I could take a couple of steps, and then my walk would freeze up, and I'd take smaller and smaller steps. Same way with singing. I'd start to sing, and it sounded like I could sing, and then all of a sudden my voice would freeze up, and my voice would cramp up, and it would just freeze.
Doesn't Parkinson's run in your family?
My grandmother had it.
So wouldn't that have been something you might have thought of as a possible
cause? It wasn't.
Cause?
I mean, I didn't think of it at all. I thought, well, here, I had two shoulder surgeries, so I thought my hand was shaking because that's the reason I finally went to a neurologist. I thought maybe during the surgery there'd been a nerve that had been, but I also had, you know, I bounced off of horses my whole life on my head and hurt my back and fell down on my roller skates. I had terrible back trouble for years and years. So I thought my back trouble, you know, was making the pain I had in my back, but it turned out that Parkinson's was actually causing all of that.
Although you've spoken to the press about it, you don't mention the Parkinson's diagnosis in the book. Did you leave it out deliberately or had the book already gone to press by the time you learned about it?
It went to press by the time I had a confirmed diagnosis. You know, when I was working on the acknowledgments, it was the first news I had from the neurologist. And he said, I watched his face. I'm pretty good at reading micro expressions. And I watched his face and I could tell he was saying, "You really have this, but I just don't want to tell you yet." They, you know, the protocol calls for them to say, "Come back in 6 months and we'll confirm the diagnosis." So.
And you've said that you don't sing at all now, even when you're alone in the shower?
I can't. I'm not able. I've tried to sing in the shower, but I sing a note, and then it just cramps up. It's just like I'd like to run, but I don't run.
and that has to
run to the
really
hospital.
Have meant a major change for you because you've been singing almost since you could talk. You decided, you say in the book, at the age of 4, not that you were going to become a singer, but that you were a singer.
I was a singer. You know, I wasn't thinking about being a star. I wasn't thinking about being famous. I wasn't thinking about making money. I was thinking about singing. I wanted to sing. And singing was what I had that expressed who I was and what I was thinking about, you know. I wasn't a good singer, but I was a 4-year-old singer. That's what I was. I wasn't a good singer for a long time. It took me 10 years to learn. They say it takes 10 years to learn how to do anything well, you know.
But what do you mean you weren't a good singer? Didn't you sing in tune, or was it?
I sang in tune, but I didn't sing with a certain kind of freedom and a certain kind of abandon where you're just absolutely lost. I would lose myself in music occasionally, but I was still searching. I was still looking. I was still thinking. At some point, I got all of my ducks in a row, and I just got lost. I could abandon myself out there, and that was exhilarating. That's a wonderful feeling when that happens in art.
Is that something you had to learn, or did it just suddenly happen?
It's something I had to practice and develop the skill and the tools. I had to develop the tools and the color and get a lot of little different colors in my paint box.
My guest is Linda Ronstadt. She's written a memoir called Simple Dreams. You come from a musical family. Your grandfather had been a professional musician.
No, he wasn't. Well, he kind of was professional, I guess. In those days, you had to make your own music. My grandfather was, in fact, a rancher, and he was also a very well-respected carriage maker in the Southwest. Like, if you needed a wagon or a nice carriage, a fancy carriage, or a really good utility wagon, you went to my grandfather. He had the best reputation for making the ones that wouldn't break down. He was a really skilled craftsman. He was apprenticed to a blacksmith when he was a boy. And he learned that as a trade, and then he eventually, you know, became successful with that business and acquired a couple of ranches and was ranching, which is a tough gig in the desert, let me tell you, and went through all the ups and downs of that. And but he was the guy that you went to. He was like the music man. He taught everybody how to play their instruments. He wrote the charts for the little band that he had. It was like an oopah band, you know, with woodwinds and brass and drums. It was just a really, like a military band, you know.
Northern Mexican music is different than the music of the rest of Mexico.
A lot of German influence kind of oompa. A lot of oompa going on there. A little some French music, too.
And then the rest of your family all sang?
Everybody sang. You know, they didn't sing necessarily to a professional level. They all sang pretty much in tune, could sing harmonies. And Everybody loved, was passionate about, you know, about beautiful songs. My grandmother and my grandfather and all my aunts and uncles were very passionate about opera. They loved traditional Mexican music. They loved the popular music of the decade, both in Spanish and in English. They loved jazz. My uncle had one arm. He played the trumpet. He loved Louis Armstrong. You know, I mean, it just, everybody, they loved everything.
And you've said that that music that you learned at home, you heard at home before you were 10 years old, provided you with material to explore for your entire career.
Yeah, I never tried to record anything that I hadn't heard by the time I was 10 years old because I just couldn't do it with any authenticity, you know.
Well, in a way, the argument could be made that anybody who wants to be a musician is lucky if they're exposed to a wide range of music when they're
Well, not only a wide range of music, but a wide range of all the arts, visual, dance. You know, I think that I love ballet, for instance. I could go watch Swan Lake. I'm corny. I love all the old war horses. I think they're fabulous. The more tulle and the more tutus, the better for me. But I can watch a ballet like Swan Lake, and it will. In the days when I could sing, it would color every single note I sang. The experience of having seen Swan Lake, or the experience of seeing a painting by someone like Maynard Dixon, or Robert Henrich, John Singer Sargent, you know, it would just color my experience literally, you know. And
you like the Ashcan School in earlier?
I love that. I love those guys. Love those guys. I have a Robert Henrich. It's a beautiful painting, but I love him. He's really good. But the Seven, I think they're called. But and in addition to that, you know, the other things that you hear, the other kinds of music that you hear, and books that I've read. I've read books. I'd keep a book on a music stand. I used to have a book of Maynard Dixon, of his art and his poetry, and I'd keep it on the music stand. I'd read music very well, but there was always that kind of boring downtime when they're switching out microphones or changing their plugs or doing whatever they do in recording studios. That could be boring for me, but I just have this book I'd look through, and I'd look at a painting, and then I'd sing about it. You know, it just changed my perception of everything else in the world. Reading classic literature changed the way I looked at the world forever. It just changed, you know, reading Henry James and Edith Wharton, and I love Thomas Hardy. I love, Jane Austen, the Bronte sisters. I love it all.
There's a grad student listening right now who's going to go through all of your music and see the connections between recordings and the people you were reading at
Well,
at
I don't know
time.
If he could, but I'll tell you, I mean, I just remember there was a book called The Unbearable Lightness of Being, which was just...
Milan Kundera.
Yeah, Milan Kundera. There's a writer that can write about music. He's a good writer. But I had that on my music stand when I was recording, around midnight. And so that was I was thinking about what it's like when somebody invades your country and you can't trust your neighbors anymore and they've taken over. It's kind of like when having George Bush for two terms is kind of made me feel like that, you know? So it's like devastating. But Nelson Riddle had a liver disease, and he was dying, and he knew he was dying. And he was writing the arrangement for Around Midnight at that time. So for me, it was about, you know, the Prague Spring. For him, it was about the fact that he was dying, and he was staring it right in the face in an absolutely sanguine way.
Well, you must have been thrilled to be singing with Nelson Riddle, who did all those classic recordings with Sinatra.
What a brilliant musician. What a wonderful composer, and what a lovely, lovely man. We had a very, very good friendship, and I miss him every day. He was very important to jazz. He was very important to pop music. He was the guy that wrote jazz into the orchestra without compromising the genre in any way, shape, or form, and certainly without compromising the orchestra.
We're going to take a little break, and when we come back, we'll talk about some other exciting musicians, some of whose names you'll recognize. If you're a Mexican, you'll know the name Lola Beltran. Linda Ronstadt's book is Simple Dreams, a musical memoir. It is published by Simon & Schuster. Stay with us for more.
Esta vida mejor que se acabe no es para mí. Pobre de mí.
Look at these eyes. They've never seen what matters. Look at these dreams. So big and so better. But I know I love you. And that may be all I need to know.
We're back with Linda Ronstadt. She's written what she calls a musical memoir, and we'll get to that in just a moment. The title is Simple Dreams, and it is published by Simon & Schuster. And we just came in with Don't Know Much, which you recorded with Aaron Neville.
Oh, Aaron Neville. I mean, I love him so much. Wherever you are, Aaron, he lives here in New York. I talk to him quite a lot, quite often, actually. And
he just did a whole bunch, a record of oldies.
Oh, my God. He's such a great singer. Getting to sing with him, I got to make sounds with my voice that I never would have been able to do on my own. You know, he just opened all these little doors for me and gave me a ladder to climb up on. I just love him. When you sing with somebody like that, it's a really passionate relationship. It's just because singing is a really intimate thing, you know. And you get to have, I mean, Aaron had a wonderful wife, Joelle, that I just loved, and he's married now, but we loved each other. You know, we had a legal love affair inside of that song that was just perfectly okay to do, and I got to dance with him every night and kiss him on stage, so it was good. I had a good time with him.
I could list the musicians that you've performed and recorded with throughout your career, but it would take up all the time we have left. Among the best known are Emmylou Harris and Dolly Parton. How many records did the three of you make together?
We made two records together, and we sang on each other's records on various tracks. But
is singing as a trio more difficult than performing in a duet?
Duets are really hard, I think. But I don't know. I think it's hard to sing good harmonies, and it's hard to sing in tune, and it's hard to blend. And there are all kinds of – there's a whole litany of little crafty tricks and techniques that you have to do to sing with somebody else. It's like being a sound chameleon. And again, I could sing with Emmy and make sounds that I'd never be able to make, and with Dolly the same way. And I think what was kind of cool about the trio is that Dolly and Emmy could sing together, Dolly and I could sing together, Emmy and I could sing together, or we could sing together all three, you know.
And the videos of you singing together on YouTube make it look like you're having a lot of fun.
I've never seen them, so I don't know. I've made it a point to not ever watch myself on YouTube, but I watched this Spanish singer, Estrella Morente, from Spain, flamenco singer. Oh, my God, I found her on YouTube. She's fabulous.
So you remain a fan as well.
I'm a huge fan. In spite of the fact that YouTube has crappy sound and lousy picture, I love it. It's so much fun.
Well, because you can find all sorts of obscure things on it.
Oh, my God. You know, I found this singer that I heard when I was two. My father had these 78 records that my aunt had brought him from Spain, a singer called Pastora Pavón. She's considered to be the great voice of flamenco, you know, for the early 20th century. She was just the greatest female singer. And I'd never heard her because those records were old, and we just played them until they wore out. I don't think they'll play still anymore. We scratched them. So I have not really, literally not heard them since I was about four. But I found her on Pastora Pavón. She was called La Nina de los Peines. I found her on YouTube and got to hear her, and it killed me the same way it killed me when I was a little kid. I don't know what it was. It was exactly the same, that voice.
This memoir is being published in both English and Spanish. Did your family speak Spanish at home?
My father did, and my grandmother did, and my aunts and uncles did. My mom.
But you had to learn it to be able to record Spanish
songs. I did. I had to work on it. I grew up pronouncing it. I could pronounce it pretty well. But, you know, we weren't encouraged to speak Spanish in school. There was a good amount of racism and, you know, xenophobia going around. And is that right? Did I say that right?
Xenophobia means...
Yeah. Fear of foreigners.
Fear of foreigners.
Okay, God. My brain isn't working anymore. So it was a tough call in school. They punished children for speaking Spanish. And, of course, my mother didn't speak Spanish, so it wasn't exactly my quote-unquote mother tongue, but I heard it all the time in the household growing up. I thought Spanish was what you sang in and English was what you spoke in.
And you've said that one of your earliest musical influences was Lola Beltran, the great ranchera singer. Do you remember what it was about her that particularly inspired you?
Well, it was her passion and her huge belt voice. I mean, she could just literally blow the walls down. And Lola Beltran was the greatest singer, ranchera singer, that ever came out of Mexico. And she really symbolized Mexico in terms of singing, like Edith Piaf symbolized France. You know, she was the voice of Mexico. And even, I think that Maria Callas even was a fan of hers. And she just had this incredible voice. It had so much rich color in it. That was a voice. She could have been a great opera singer. She could have been a ballad singer. She could have been a pop singer. She could have been anything. I'm so glad she sang ranchera music because she really inspired me.
And then you had to learn how to perform these old Mexican songs that you'd grown up with. Weren't your producers concerned by your decision to put out a record consisting entirely of songs sung in Spanish?
Well, they thought I had absolutely lost my mind. I mean, after I did all the Nelson Riddle stuff, they went, okay, you know, self-indulgence to the max. Here, we got away with the last one, but we're not going to get away with it twice. And I was just determined to sing it. I loved it. I felt completely passionate about it. I felt it defined who I was more than anything I'd ever heard or sung. And I was determined to get it up to professional speed. So I found a mariachi band, very, very, very good in Los Angeles, Los Camperos de Naticano, just the finest band I've ever worked with. And I found those guys, and I started working with them. And they taught me. They were very generous, you know. They could have been really selfish and, God, she's not one of us. Who you know, is this gringa think she is, or this bocha, you know, because I'm Mexican-American. There's a real difference. Mexican-American culture is different from Mexico. It's different from the United States. We call it the culture of Aztlan. And it's a third culture. It's like a third nationality in a way that's influencing both the culture of Mexico and the culture of the United States profoundly. And it's really interesting to me. But they could have kept me over in that category and not taught me, but they didn't. They were really, really nice.
Well, we have any number of people who celebrate Mexican culture in the United States. They just don't want any more Mexicans to come into the United States.
Well, that's too bad for them because they're coming, you know. They're coming, and the best thing to do is give them as generous a share of the economic pie as you can do, because they're here, they're ready to work, they come from a really high moral background. And the only reason that ever collapses is because they're shoved out of they're not allowed to share in the economy. They're shoved into the shadows, and they're not allowed to work.
So what happened? You recorded the first Mexican album, despite your producer's misgivings, and you were worried that nobody would come to your concerts or that they would start yelling out for Blue Bayou?
We were worried about that, so we advertised very carefully that it was going to be entirely in Spanish. And only in Boston did somebody yell for Blue Bayou. That was the only place that we had any trouble. But the other things, what happened was the concert, the tickets didn't sell. There were no pre-sales. So we went, oh, my God, nobody's coming. And the promoter thought, oh, I'm going to lose my shirt, because we played the same places that we played when we played rock and roll. So, you know, sure enough, the night of the concert, people showed up. The place was jammed. And they showed up, you know, multiple generations came, like, you know, grandparents came and babies came. It was just as a classic Mexican audience. The entire family comes, and they know exactly the right place to hoot and holler. It's not like playing to an Anglo audience where you're singing some delicate, like I was singing Heart Like a Wheel, some delicate little ballad air. Hey, wave, you know. It's not like that.
They're much more respectful.
They really are, and they know just exactly where to yell, and it just helps, you know, pull you up over that next wave. It's really cool.
Now, you said that the mariachi band was the best musicians you ever worked with. You sang with Neil Young, who may be one of the greatest guitarists that ever lived.
Oh, my God. I also had Ray Brown in my band and Plaz Johnson.
The great bass player.
Yeah. I mean, my God, I had great musicians. I was so lucky in that way to get those guys to play with me, you know. But I never had a better band than the Mariachi Los Camperos. I had bands that were as good, Mariachi Vargas, of course.
So when you were working with different people, did you look for a shared musical sensibility like Neil Young or Paul Simon or Graham Parsons?
Well, not with those guys. They were way over my head, you know. I mean, to get musicians, you'd look for people that kind of chase the same things you'd been chasing. You can find people that would chase exactly those things, but you'd find people that were sort of compatible in that way. Guys like Neil and Paul were gracious enough to invite me at different times to come and sing on their records, and I was very thrilled to get to participate in that.
You didn't have any professional vocal training until fairly late in your career. When you're preparing for Pirates of
the Caribbean? Yeah, when I was doing Pirates. And 8 shows a week, are you kidding me, you know? And 2 on Wednesday and 2 on Friday and 2 on Saturday, and 2 on Saturday, I guess, and a matinee on Sunday. I mean, it's just an unbelievable schedule. And, of course, my voice was just, you know, giving up the ghost. And they said, well, you have to go talk to Marge Rivingston, who is this wonderful, they call her Magic Marge, and she was the one that would coach all these Broadway professionals and teach it. Mainly what her specialty was in learning how to be a high belter. Well, I already had that one down. I know a high belt. I needed how to learn how to sing in a mix, which is that, you know, you sort of marry your head voice to your chest voice in some kind of way. And I never quite figured that out completely, but I did pretty well eventually. Not enough to sing like a legit singer or like an opera singer, but it worked for the standards, like what's new.
Because you don't want to sound like you're switching gears when you go from your chest voice to
your
head voice.
But in Mexican music, you want to crack your voice. You know, you want to go with your chest voice all the way up to the top and then go, ooh, and into your falsetto and start yodeling. It's exactly what you want to do.
Now, you said one of the good things about doing Pirates of Penzance was it allowed you to stay in the same place for a while, New York City. Did you not like touring?
I didn't like touring because I had to pack my suitcase every single day and go to a different city. And they do that for 4 or 5 months at a time. And it was just drove you crazy, you know. But then I got to New York and I went, oh, my God. You know when they say you're in the theater? Well, you're in that damn theater from, you know, 12 on the matinee day. I'd arrive at noon and I wouldn't leave until 11:30 at night. It was a long time to be inside the theater.
Right. You didn't get to see a lot of New York.
No, I didn't. I lived across the street from the Museum of Natural History, which I always wanted to go and see, and I never got to see it.
Your book subtitle is a musical memoir. Obviously, you wanted to distinguish it from all the tell-all memoirs that have been written.
Yeah, that's not what my book is doing.
You do mention...
Tells all about the music is what it does.
I would assume that an editor or the publisher was pressuring you to talk more about Jerry Brown or Pete Hamill or some of the other people you've been linked to.
He pressured me to make it longer. It was in my contract that it wasn't going to be a kiss-and-tell book and that it wasn't going to talk about any of that stuff.
Now, did you write it yourself?
How smart I am. I put it in my contract. I'm sorry, what?
Well, why did you feel it necessary to keep all that stuff out?
Because it wasn't what I was writing about. I was writing about the music.
Did you write it all yourself?
It was a story I set out to tell. Pardon?
There's no ghostwriter listed.
No, I wrote the whole thing myself, for better or for worse. Wrote it on my laptop in my bed.
Now, you've had this pretty terrific career. You've met so many different people. You in the book, you talk about how much you learned from all of them. We didn't even get to the McGarrigles and the Wainwrights and and others who you write so warmly about. It must be very tough right now to not be singing. Does the writing take up that space?
It doesn't really. Nothing can take up that space, and I just have to accept that. The McGarrigles and the entire family, the McGarrigle Wainwright family, came to town and did a Christmas concert last year, and I went to see it, and Emmylou was singing with them, and I just would have given anything to get up there and sing with them. But, you know, I mean, not even to get up there. I would have given anything to go and rehearse with them or go and sing in their living room after the show because I love them so much. But I can't do it, you know. I can sit in the audience and watch Emmylou, and in my brain I'm running through the harmonies I would be singing with her, but I can't sing them.
Well, one of the songs that Anna wrote, Heart Like a Wheel, was really important to your career.
It changed my life musically. I went, finally, it was like Eureka, I found it, you know. I think that what a lot of us were chasing were really trying hard not to sound pretentious, and for lack of a better term, but there was such a thing called art song, you know, and in the time of John Jacob Niles, who wrote Black is the Color of My True Love's Hair, and, I can't remember what else he wrote. Anyway, he wrote a lot of songs that I love. And that tradition seemingly died out, you know, that idea that you have this kind of artfully crafted thing with a little bit of an orchestration to it, you know, simple orchestration. It didn't really die out. I mean, the Gershwins wrote art song, if anything. Joni Mitchell writes art song. Leonard Cohen writes art song. And the McGarrigles certainly wrote art song. And when I heard that, I didn't know what to call it, but I knew that that's what I wanted. It was a much more refined sensibility with unbridled sentiment.
And also, those kinds of songs suit your voice pretty well.
Well, they suited my voice. I made my voice suit them. I wasn't going to let anything get in the way of singing that song, you know.
You never married, but you adopted 2 children, a boy and a girl.
Right.
Did they share your passion for music?
Well, my son's a good guitar player. He learned all by himself. He's a lefty. I couldn't teach him. He's completely self-taught. He learned a lot of stuff off the internet. A lot of really generous guitar players, super, you know, brilliant guitar players, share their little techniques and their ideas on the internet. It's a new ball game. So he's kind of a solitary player. He hasn't played with a lot of bands, but whenever he gets in a band, he plays just fine. He's got a real solid sense of the groove. He's got great pitch. He really understands how to sort of pull that sound out of the guitar. But I don't think that that's his major passion. He's interested in physics. He likes tech stuff, you know. They're all techies, these kids.
We're going to go out with Blue Bayou, one of your best love recordings and a favorite of baseball players, who used to describe a called third strike on a fastball as a Ronstadt because it blew by you.
And my son had to explain that to me. He's a Giants fan, huge Giants fan.
Linda Ronstadt's memoir, musical memoir, is called Simple Dreams. It is published by Simon & Schuster. Thank you so much for being on our
show. Thank you for inviting me. I had a really nice time. You made it easy.
I'm so lonesome all the time since I left my baby behind on Blue Bayou. Saving nickels, saving dimes, working till the sun don't shine, looking forward to happier times on